Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 10th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Walt Waldron Jr. Today's session number is 98-9, and it's titled, You Might As Well Be a Nun. Let's listen in.
Let me tell him to roll the tape and give you my name and then do something that has nothing to do with anything, so that as people come in, they're not missing anything. Fred Niebner, my friend, always begins with Holden hilarity, and I don't have any hilarity in my body. So I thought I'd read you, as a matter of fact, what is going to be my next column. It'll come out in August Lutheran. But it's also a piece that's going to appear in this Christmas collection if ever I finish and get it published. And it's a nice way of saying hello to you. Throughout the Christmas collection, one of the things I've been dealing with is tears, actually, in a variety of ways in which a baby may suddenly appear crying and what that might mean. And near the end of it, I have this small piece, and all I'll tell you is called Jesus and John, a Fantasy. And I'll read it and just let you think what you think about it, then we'll get started. On his way to being born in Bethlehem, the Lord Jesus stopped for a chat with his cousin in the hill country of Judea. Even cause, he said, and sat. Now, John was a bairn about 6 months old, hadn't commenced baptizing yet, but a prophet's a prophet from his mother womb, so saith the holy book. And 'tis a prophet's aptitude to chat with the Lord, so John says, even. And the Lord says, you know me, do you? And John says, we met. And the Lord says, aye, in your ma you punched your lung to let her know 'twas me and mine. And it was you, says John, lighting a briar and crossing his legs. But 'twas a bigger you. You have diminished. I've been 9 months deflating, John. And well you should, said John, leaning forward, blowing smoke. For a full, fleshy-sized god foot and would stomp new oceans till no himself would drown. The good Lord nods and accepts a briar from his cousin and crosses his legs. 'Tis a humbling, John, he says. 'Tis a humbling down I'm doing. We'll be thanking you for it in time. For the smallness, says the Lord. Aye, and for salvation too. So the Lord and his cousin puff a while, enjoying some peace before the hullabaloo of the nativity gets started. Finally, the good Lord Jesus says, so how's it feel, cuz? What's it like to be stuffed in the flesh like the hiss in the skin of a sausage? He'll cry, says John. Tears? Aye, tears. Some for sorrow, some for love. The human eye is a wet thing altogether, declaring the news of the heart. But do you like that suit of skin, John? Is it a good thing to be in? Now the waymaker taps the ash in his briar and leans forward and taps the knee of the Lord. Here's the thing concerning bodies, John says. Till you've got one, you can't sense how fair the fair world is. A spirit, he knows things straight on and no middling conveyance to bring it in. He wants to know some worthy matter, boom, he knows it. But a body's bound to the conveyance of knowledge, comes through things in pieces it does. Through the wet eye, as for an instant, says John, nodding. In order for the brain to know that eye, well, she's got to see, don't you know it, Lord? And what she sees, why, it is so fair. 'Tis fair and lovely the world that was made, and a loss if it cannot be seen. This, by the way, is an idea that I shared with you, I think, Tuesday. You're beginning to recognize it. And the ear, says John, in a transport of fleshly delights, the ear, she's a busy gossip indeed, catching the chirp of a bird in the morning, and the laugh of a lass, and the thump of a good thunder. And what would I do could I never lay hands in my poor mum's face to feel the love that lies in her for me? 'Tis a delicious thing ahead of you, Lord, to know by the use and conveyance of your five bodily senses, 'tis the slow but savory way. Aye, cuz, says the Lord, then. I hear ye and I thank ye. But if the body's a means for enjoying beauty, why are ye weeping in front of me now, John? Well, John pulls the tam from his head and sighs. By reason of, he says, 'tis all so lonely in here. 'Tis a prison not straight to know or to be known. And the senses, Lord, begging pardon for the complaint, ain't always accurate. So the body's a barrier, you know. But once you're born, the body's what maintains your life. Ha, ha, there's a joke to make you cry. John leans back and gives a grimace shout, tickled by his own wit. And that, he shouts, is what you'll do at the barnum, Lord, to prove you're living. Ha, ha! First word out of the word of the God, you'll cry. Whoo! What an ironical thing this living is. Now the Lord knocks the ash from his own briar and gazes full into his cousin's moisty eye. Indeed, he says, and no surprise that I should cry, John. It's the plan, cuz, and if you cry a little, I'll cry the flood. For I'll be crying with you, John, and I'll be crying for you too, on account of ye and on behalf of ye. I'll cry the tears to wash your sins. I'll cry the fountain to take your thirst away. I'll water your feverish, burning face with me own wet hand. And when it's done, and well done too, I'll come and wipe the tears away. All of the tears of all of the people that ever did cry, save mine. 'Tis the thing that makes me a god like none other, John. I've come to cry. Well, 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 says John, wiping his brow from the crown of his tam. Phew, he says, you've uttered the sermon that wants a mount. You got the kick of authority, Lord. So, let's see. So as to make me tingle for doing. What do you wish that I do? Now the Lord Jesus stands and stretches his back muscles after sitting and chatting so long. Well, cuz, he says with a wink, 'tis more than a wish. It's a consecration, even from your mother's belly, that you should be washing things. Aye, and what sort of things? Bodies, John. The eyes and the ears and the hands and the brains and the skin of the people. Sink them in a Noah flood and raise them up clean for me. Thank you, cuz. Thanks for the chat and the good forewarning and the blackthorn briar as well. I'm off to my bornin'. Goodbye. Just fun. Anyway, my name is Walt Wandry, in case anyone listened that long to the tape without knowing what was going on. I've been talking about some of the passions of a writer this week. I spend a good deal of time indicating that it seems to me there's a sort of moral responsibility that writers get it right and do it carefully. Those of you who are just coming, I don't think you'll feel lost for what I say today, but I've been following, oh, excuse me, I gotta get out of this Irish accent. It's stuck. Can't get it out of me. I've been following a really wonderful short book by Annie Dillard called Holy the Firm, in which she really roots deep in what it means to be a writer as well as an artist in general, I believe. And the first day I talked about the artist's passion for the craft. This both makes us the same and divides us. My passion is for the craft of writing, words, stories, narrative, poetry, lines. Who was it said that when he dies he'll feel happy because when he writes one good sentence it thrills him through his soul? Gore Vidal. Gore Vidal said that, and I absolutely understand that. But see, that's my craft, and then others are potters. And that's what makes us the same and divides us. All the arts have their craft. And most artists, at some point, develop a sort of passion for the craft. And that passion sometimes overheaps you, you know? Some of you have children who started playing guitar young, and you couldn't stop the twerk. I mean, he'd wake up or she'd get up early in the morning or late at night and plunk away in that guitar and try things. And you wouldn't even know what that kid is trying, but they're just trying things. And they're frustrated. You know, it's like my brother playing tennis and not getting it right. He's not happy. He's not happy, but he's got to get it right. He won't play with me because he says I ruin his game. And he only plays with my father for honor of my father. But so you see these kids playing and they're not happy. But something's driving them to get that thing right. And when they get it right, all of a sudden, the whole universe clicks for just a moment. The whole universe just clicks. It just goes click. And in that moment, it's in order. And then it goes on. And for those clicks, you know, you keep coming back at it. You keep, and all kinds of loss and so forth. So now I don't have to repeat my Monday's lecture. The second thing I talked about was the passion for the other. I don't know if this goes through all the arts. I wouldn't pretend to say so. But I know that in my case and in writing, and I think in any art that really seeks an audience of some kind, there is this sense that you have a relationship with other. And I talked at great length about how to read other people. I also talked about what love for one particular other person grants us an insight to those things, genders, races, ages, all the differences human beings have, insight into those differences so that we can, I call by sympathetic imagination, find ourselves in the bodies and experiences of other people. The last two times, I guess, I talked about the general relationship, the universal relationship between the artist and people in general. And I followed Annie Dillard, who suggests that love is the thing that makes pain. She says that the world seems to be an illusion most of the time. Where the illusion seems to just shatter for us is when we have an association or relationship with someone else, and that someone else feels pain. She says these two things are real. Love is real, and pain is real. And in that moment, when somebody for whom you have a relationship feels some kind of loss or pain, I tried to say last time, then comes the artist's moment. Are you going to live in the darkness with that person long enough and pay strict and ignorant attention to all the details involved so that your art begins once again to sing? Now, I'm going to use the phrase I didn't use yesterday, but this comes directly from Rilke, from Rainer Maria Rilke, to sing the world with all the details that are right there in flux and in danger, to sing those details in those world back into a kind of a harmony again. Even a meaning that you cannot put to words. Art has this beauty of always being more than it can say, and I hate to say this word, but meaning more than anyone could ever explain. You don't reduce art to the explanations of meaning and still have art. You have explanations. You don't reduce God to a theology and still have God. Forgive me, you have theology, which is talk about God. This may mean nothing to any of you who are just joining. I don't know. But I thought what I would do today, then, is to give some examples of how this works when one does not, and then when one does live with another human being long enough to live in that sort of nonsensical world with someone else, and then using the craft to put things back together again. Yesterday I stressed what Annie Dillard talked about. She thinks that when we live in the actual physical stuff of this world, she says that it becomes sacramental. You don't look up to find God, you look down, you look at where people are, you look at the very stuff of their existence. And the more that you pay, not selective, but intense attention to these things, and the more they become the stuff of the song that you're going to be singing, the more they really begin to weave a world again for the people who had lost a world. Does that make a little sense? I know some of you are new, and you're rowing really hard to keep up with me. Rilke, which I didn't get to last time, and I don't have time to this time, but Rilke is one of my favorite poets, especially in the development of his life. At the end of his life, he came up with the three-word declaration that we should use in the practicing of our faith. This is his words. This is in, I have to give it to you in German. And then I'll try to translate it to you in various ways, but you have to hear how it is. Gesang ist da sein. Gesang means song or singing. It's more than just a single song. It's the business of singing. It's being. Song is being. Or to sing is to be alive. I mean, you can play this many, many ways, and that's the best way I know. I'm sorry. I don't know how to take it out of the German. But this has something to do with taking a hold of these details and re-singing them or replaying them or refashioning or shaping them or placing them in front of people so that those who dwell in your art, and who don't stand on the outside objectively trying to interpret it, those who dwell in your art find their world by that art falling into a kind of a meaningful shape again. Always greater than the words. Yes? Here's where I did it poorly. Here's where I didn't do it. And so this is a confession of sin. But maybe it'll be an example of the choices before people when they don't choose right. On Thursday nights at Grace Church, I've been talking about Grace this whole time, and I decided to focus most of my stories on the ministry that I had. This is inner city congregation. Essentially black. It was all black when we started there, and then it began to integrate. I always had adult class on Thursday nights. In our basement. You know, we had an upstairs and a basement, that was it. Upstairs, 20 pews. 11 on one side, 9 on the other, so you could walk down the aisle and out and down outside, or down the stairs into our fellowship hall, which was the basement. Here was the chancel, and down there was the kitchen, and a little single room, and bathroom, and boiler room. That's our church, that was our facility. So downstairs, I would teach the adult class, which I really did take pleasure in a lot. It was mostly people from the neighborhood, and every time I would teach people who hadn't had any kind of thoughtful religious education, I would think through it again. On a particular Thursday night, I was teaching in the rain, worse than this. It clapped thunder. It was a spring storm, a very frightening storm. Next to our church, we had what used to be the parsonage, but it had become a place for offices and mimeograph machines and Sunday school rooms, a very small brick house. And I would see, as the lightning flashed outside, I could just see it stutter through the basement windows to where that house was on the side. Can you see that? Here's the whole thing. And out of my little office here, we may, when we start in the south, could you close those things? If it gets really hot, we'll open them up again. Maybe you all didn't notice it. I did. New songs is where it breaks in, you know. Old songs, you can begin not to, when one keeps playing, you can begin not to hear it. Okay, I could see the lightning, not the lightning itself, but I could see the house and the concrete between, it wasn't far, get wet, and it was just sheeting rain coming down. And so we decided to check and maybe to stop early. I looked outside, and literally, Elliott Street was a lake. We have very poor, maybe they've changed it, but we had a very poor sewage system in the inner city there. And any time it rained, we'd have a lake. Cars were up to their skirts right now, and they're going to go higher, and the rain is coming down very, very hard, so we called it. Most of the people were able to get to their cars, but one fellow had to wait with me. His name was Lucian Snaden. This is Thursday night, 8:30, dark, and it's pouring down rain. Here is Elliot. There is Gum on the other side of the chancel, if you can see all this. Our door came out here, so we are waiting underneath Eve, Lucian Snaden and I. Lucian, I'm not quite sure what to say. He would never go to college because the level of his intelligence has a certain limit to it. And I think he just barely made high school, although he did. And he was working at McDonald's and doing it very well. He was, I think, in many spiritual ways, an intelligent fellow, but not very talky, very shy and withdrawn. He was about my height. And I think then he became a manager of a restaurant after a little while, too, and very proud of it. Lucian Snaden, who was about 18 years old at that point, and I were standing, and it was raining, we were facing this way. Suddenly I heard a crash on the other side of the church, back where that house was. And at first I thought it was just the lightning and so forth. And then I thought I'd go check because it sounded like glass. So I walked around the church, Lucian waiting, his parents are supposed to be coming. I walked around the church and looked between where the church was with all of its lights on, and where the parish house was. Standing on that cement sort of porch and leaning into a broken window was a robber. There was a robber. I walked through, it's sort of like when you're fishing, you don't expect fish, and there's a big fish right there. There's a robber. And he's leaning and he's reaching in through the window into where my office is. I can see that when the lightning flashes. Now, we had two break-ins already. And the first one of those break-ins stole some of our mimeograph and our machine, or I don't know what, computers, something like that. And another one had broken into the church itself, and for some reason they didn't take our brass candlesticks, but twice we had been broken into in the last 6 months. And I was really upset. This is odd to tell you, but I was angry that he would be so stupid as to break into that when there were lights on in the church. Couldn't he at least... What do you say? Canvas the joint. What do you say? What do you say? Case the joint and see the preacher on the other side and go to a different church. Go to the Baptists. The Catholics are up the street and he's breaking. And so all this just went shooting through my mind. We've already been broken into. We've lost some stuff. I'm here. The lights are on. What is he doing breaking into my office? I said, show me your face. I make apologies. I don't understand all the things I did. I said, show me your face. And this poor guy came back like that, and he looked at me, and I wanted to see his face so that I would be able to say who this was, and I would tell the cops, I would tell everyone, I don't want this guy to be a secret. So I said, show me your face. It's like, what's your identity? Who are you? Sign on the dotted line. And this poor guy, very skinny, pulls up, and the lightning flashes, and he sees me standing there, and I always think I'm relatively small, you know, I think I'm a pushover. That's what I think I am, but when I get upset, I must not look like that because his poor eyes went pow, pow. He saw me standing there in the lightning and the rain. And the poor guy turned and he ran off the porch and he started running toward Gum. And I was was so angry at him, I ran right after him. Boom, up on the porch. I was suddenly athletic. You know how anger can all of a sudden make you like you never are before in your life. Either great anger or great love. And anger is faster. I went over that porch and chased this poor guy as fast as he, but it was terror in him and it was rage in me. And his feet spun on that wet grass down the hill to where Gum was. And he slipped, his feet went out underneath him, and he was scrambling, trying to get away. I flung and landed on him. I landed on the guy just as he was turning over, and I pinned him to the ground. I said, "What are you doing here? What are you doing?" I was so furious. And he just, he couldn't talk. And he just was, this. I mean, I, I was in terror of his life. And worse than that, the lightning flashed. And here it is, the lightning flash, and I interpreted the whole world to him, just like a writer, just like a poet, just like a preacher, the lightning flash, and I interpreted. I pointed up, I said, "That's for you." I really did. I get this from my mother. We are both dramatic. We use whatever happens around us. It's all tools. God gives us anything. I said, "That's for you." And his eyes went wide. I said, "God says, don't you ever come back here again." And the lightning flashed again. I said, "God says, never come back again." And I leaned back like that. I can get a big voice, you can understand. I have a very big voice. I'm a Lutheran preacher. No, I think I'm a Baptist preacher. This poor guy turned over and scrambled. I think he didn't go under the water. I think his feet patched on top of it as he went across Gum and Gone. Whew, I felt proud. When you are angry, a righteous anger, and you're able to express it, and it has this kind of success, suddenly you're totally free of your rage, and you now feel that righteousness is pure and undefiled. I went round back to the church, and I stood next to Lucian under the little porch like this. "Well," I said, "I took care of that." He looked at me. I said, "Yep." I said, "I ran that robber out of here. He's never coming back." Now, I honestly don't know what Lucian was thinking at that moment. But I thought he was going to, you know, like take my hand, pat me on the back, say, "Yep, you're an inner city person just like us," or something. But he just looked at me, and there was no praise in his face. There was no smile. He just looked, and I don't know if it was Lucian or God or my mother or who, but I think I saw him go like this. And as soon as he did that, all of a sudden everything reversed in my mind. Here, now let me see. Here came someone to church, whatever his motives were, and the pastor met him at the office. And the pastor turned a storm into the wrath of God and told this man never to come back again. Oh. In a moment, now this is half a joke, but in a moment when the chasm was there, I used my skill, you know, please, in those moments I talked about last time, when the chasm opens for other people and you may enter with them or not, it isn't just whether or not you're going to use your skill, your craft. You will use your craft for good or ill. I will use it, good or bad. It's just, will I use it for the people? Will I be with them for all, or against them, or against them? And I really did for a moment act in pure righteousness. I was a tzaddikim. I was a righteous one, as sometimes we think righteousness ought to be. I won't say much more about it. I hope that you ravel it out as much as you can in your brain. But imagine when the church becomes so righteous in itself that it thinks it ought to take over the powers of government. Not to speak the mercy of God unto other people or the invitation of God, but rather to declare furiously the divisions among ourselves. Divisions that say, "I am right and you're wrong." And we can do that very powerfully. And artists, you know, I mean, this is the caution to all artists. Whatever I do, I will use craft. But I could use my craft to hurt people. I really could, a lot. Stan?
Knowing what you know now, how would you have dealt with that differently?
I would hope. I mean, all I can say is hope, Stan. Because I was rising, obviously I was rising from a lot of feelings, and I was just getting used to the inner city and everything. But I think at this point, I would not have acted with such rage. I don't think I would have shouted. I don't think I would have been adversarial right away. I don't think I would have liked it. I mean, I really would not have liked it. That's a lot of work to fix that window. It was raining inside and so forth, and I don't think I would have acted like I liked it. I wouldn't have said, "Oh, poor soul, come with me." But I might have engaged a conversation. And in fact, when that sort of thing happened later on, after we started the Mission of Grace, we began to see that each of these acts, which I don't know how we thought of them, but any act where the neighborhood bumped against us, sometimes asking for gifts from us because we had that mission, or sometimes, you know, angry at us or whatever. We saw every one of those, we began to see them, especially a woman, Rose Smith, I'll tell you some others, we began to see them as opportunities of conversation, at least as the beginning of the potential of dialogue, and learned. But I'm you know, obviously right now, I'm really looking good in my answer. That's the best I can say. But let me give you another one. No, I need to read you Annie Dillard. Can you take a little reading? Mm-hmm. Don't you love this woman? Have you come to love her as I read? I hope you get the book. It is, I use this when I teach my students sometimes, creative writing. And some of them work so hard and don't really understand. And I understand, you have, there comes a moment when you can understand. Listen to how she talks about the details. This is near the end of the book now, and she's speaking as the writer. Hoopla, she says, all that I see arches and light arches around it. The air churns out forces and lashes the marbling land. I just walked down and up in the rain, 6 miles altogether above. And you don't do that without looking. And what do you do with what you see? What do you do with what you see? You don't have to put words to it, but she does. 100 times through the fields and along the deep roads I've cried holy. I see, and this is her now, this is rising now. Listen to all the details. She is like the seraphim, she's saying. Like the seraphim who stand in the presence of God, who love God so much that although they should cry three holies, they only get one out before they consume themselves in a fire of love. All along the deep roads I have cried holy. I see 100 insects moving across the air, rising and falling. Chipped notes of birdsong descend from the trees, tuneful and broken. The notes pile about me like leaves. Why do these molded clouds make themselves overhead, innocently changing, trailing the flat blue shadows up and down everything and passing and gone? Ladies and gentlemen, you are given insects and birdsong and replenishing series of clouds. The air is buoyant and wholly transparent, scoured by grasses. The earth stuck through it is noisome, blighted, and salt. Who shall ascend to the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? Whom shall I send, heard the first Isaiah. And who will go for us? And poor Isaiah, who happened to be standing there, and there was no one else, burst out, here I am, send me. There is Julie Norwich. Julie Norwich salted with fire. This little girl whose face was burned off. Most of you remember from yesterday. She is preserved like a salted fillet from all evil, baptized at birth into time and now into eternity by her suffering and the blade-like arms of God. She's not dead, by the way. I thought so when I first read this. For who will love her now without a face when women with faces abound and people are so? People are reasoned while God is mad. They love only beauty. Who knows what God loves? Happy birthday, little one and wise. You got there early, the easy way. The world knew you before you knew the world. The gods in their boyish, brutal games bore you like a torch, a firebrand recklessly over the heavens to the glance of the one God, fathomless and mild, dissolving into the sheets. Her face dissolves. You might as well be a nun. Here's my title. Talking to the artists, talking to those of you with skill, those of you who are counselors, preachers, teachers, mothers, fathers, aunts. You might as well be a nun. You might as well be God's chaste bride, chased by the plunderers to the high caves of solitude, to the hearthless rooms empty of voices and of warm limbs hooking your heart to the world. Look how he loves you. Are you bandaged now or loose in a sterilized room? Wait till they hand you a mirror and see if you can hold one and know what it means. The skinlessness, that black shroud of flesh in strips on your skull, that is your veil. That's what suffering does. There are two kinds of nun, out of the cloister or in. You can serve or you can sing. You can serve or you can sing and wreck your heart in prayer, working the world's hard work. Forget whistling. You have no lips for that or for kissing the face of a man or a child. Learn Latin and it please the Lord. Learn the foolish downward look called the custody of the eyes. And learn power, however sweet they call you. Learn power, the smash of the holy once more, and sign by its name. You might as well be a nun. You don't have to be in the midst of all these things. I think, by the way, the cloistered and the not. And what she says, the cloistered are there, and I believe this, they're praying all day long for the sake of the whole world, just as the Lakota do. And the world is heavier for their prayers. The prayers are here. Even though you don't know those nuns and you don't know their names and their faces are hidden, because artists are never, you know, when the candle is burning, who looks at the wick? When it's out, who cares? They're praying. Or there are those who are out. There are the nuns who are out, who kneel in the streets and whose faces you don't see. You know, they're burned away. The artist's face is burned away, who take care of others. After I was no longer the senior pastor at Grace, when Fan and I, although I was still working at Grace, Fan and I were sort of watching, doing a variety of things, there came into our community a husband and a wife and two children. For a while, we were their friends, and we thought this friendship could go a distance. The man had come in a spiritual capacity into our community. But after about three, I don't know how long it was, after a little while, his daughter went to the hospital and we realized that she had tried to commit suicide. And so I went to visit her together with her father, and I saw this odd thing. We were in a corner. We were in a psychiatric ward at Welburn Hospital, and we visited her in a corner. It was a corner with a chair here and a sofa, two chairs and a chair and a little table and a light. And she was there and he was there and I was here, thinking they should be close together. And the man, the whole time I was there, sat like this. He had glittering eyes. He had glittering blue eyes, which always struck me. They looked like eyes that genuinely had the potential of depth, either looking at you or receiving your look, except that his eyes just gazed straight ahead. And his poor daughter, who was in high school, she was, I think, a freshman in high school and having a difficult time, would jump like a little girl from where she was to his lap and fawn on him and touch him, and he just sat like this, straight ahead, which seemed odd to me because she had just tried to commit suicide. He wasn't responding to her, but she was just all over him. And that wasn't the only time. Then a little while later, she tried to commit suicide again, and we began to realize that there was something wrong inside the family itself. Some of that was realization because we could interpret it, and we were close enough to the family. Some of that was because then there came a break between the father and the mother, between the husband and the wife. And just to make this short, what we found out was that this father had abused his daughter in the past, had abused his daughter, and that they had gone through counseling and they thought that they were getting better and all that, but this poor child was so confused that the second time she tried to commit suicide, it got scary. It got very scary. And when, actually this is in the midst of a divorce, and before we realized it, Fan said she would help the woman and I said I will help the man, because they were our friends, and I would sit with that man and talk. And more what I got was a man who was just filled up with himself, just bitter, who could be angry at the world for all kinds of justification, angry even within the spiritual quality of his service in that city, angry. And I have to admit to you that as I talked to that man and talked to the daughter and sat with the daughter, now the mother is working for us. That's the money that she's making in this break. She's working with Than and helping me as a writer. The man did nothing. I got so upset. I got angry. And I would sit with that girl and talk to her or listen to her or say nothing at all. And then I wrote a letter. I wrote a letter to the child, actually. And this, let me just pause. This is the choice you don't make consciously. This is the choice which is given unto you. This is the vocation and invocation. This is the calling and the larger call. You sit with people like this. And you don't choose, you understand? Please, the artist doesn't just say, okay, now I'm going to do this craft thing. You're always doing it, whether it's in your head or not. So I write a letter. And my letter is to her. And it says something about my feelings, but it says a lot about her. And what it is like we're in this abyss together. How do we name this? What's going on here? Only when I'm finished with my letter, with my feelings and everything else like that, I think, oh no, this is too much for the child to read. And somehow it goes into the office upstairs in our house where Than and where her mother work. And I don't know how this happened, but her mother came upon the letter and read it. And she says, my daughter needs to see this. And so, sure, she took it to her daughter and the daughter read it. And the daughter said, after a while, I mean, it was good. It was a good letter. And the daughter said she thought it could be published. So I published it in one of my columns. And in fact, it has become a book. This is the opposite of the thief story. And this is only by the grace of God things like this are written. And I really mean that. That is not false humility. I merely react. I am calling this Little Lamb Who Made Thee. It's also the title of the book. And it has to be, you can't be false with the details, can you? You can't be circumlocution type thing. You've got to be straight on. Otherwise, who are you with them? If you're with them, so here it is. Secretly beaten, sexually abused. Oh, child, it's not your fault. You do not have to earn the approval of your tormentor, no, nor his forgiveness either. Is it strange that a victim thinks she caused the wrong and must right it again? Well, not so strange when we consider her helplessness. She's looking for leverage, some principle by which to control her horror. If her sin caused the punishment, then she might prevent it by a confession, see? The victim seeks her own iniquity, and the Christian faith is made grotesque, and the abuser has become a destroyer, body and soul. No, child, it was his act. He was its cause. He was its doer. He took the wretched benefit. He must own it now. Not you. Not you. He did it. But because of your native innocence, which your tormentor encourages, since it shifts his guilt to you, and because you crave order in dangerous chaos, some ethical order anyway, you see a connection between one's behavior and one's fate. The good get good and the bad get hurt. And look at the mess you're in, so you must be bad. Is that how you think? It saves the world from absurdity, doesn't it? It argues a certain rationality in human affairs. Good is rewarded, evil is punished, right? And your punishment proves evil in yourself, right? Wrong. Absolutely, unequivocally wrong. If you have suffered abuse, the one who abused you sinned. Gotta say that clearly. Gotta say that. Sin is an uncaused evil. Responsibility sticks to the sinner. The sin came from him. He is the source. He bears the blame. His is the shame. Not you. Not yours. Do you hear me? You, my child, you, dear lamb, you are beautiful and clean. This sin occurred because a fool considered himself superior to you, his whim superior to your health, his desire superior to your body, his mood superior to your peace. But you were made in the image of God. So his action condemns him. He demeans the creature whom God exalted. He attacks the child whom heaven loves. Listen. Such spiritual blindness, such bestial selfishness, such a pitiful lack of self-control declares this fool your inferior. The sinner tells me that it was his parents' fault in the first place. His father did him the same way. His mother was silent and critical. He didn't, he tells me, have a chance. He can't help his breeding and his personal shaping. But if this is true, then we're all a cosmic landfill for every sin that ever occurred before us. They fall on us from past generations, all the way back to Cain. Such a weight of sin must crush our innocent souls. Such an undeserved history must kill us. Now, but if it hasn't killed us, it hasn't. In other words, there must be some break in this chain of responsibility. Sinners causing sinners to sin. Abusive parents turning their children into abusive parents. And there is the acceptance of responsibility by the sinner. Is the break. Doesn't do to blame another. You, sir, as perpetrator of a vile abuse, must with a contrite heart confess. And you, the child whom he ravaged, must not call yourself ugly. You aren't. His action does not define you. You, child, you are as soft as the blue sky. Touch your cheek. Do you feel the fabric of life there? Yes, God wove you more lovely than wool of the clouds, smoother than petals of lily, sweeter than amber honey, kinder than the eyes of the children of her, smarter than foxes, brighter than sunshine. Listen to me. You are beautiful. You are beautiful. If you think you're ugly, you've let that fool define you. Don't do that. Touch your throat. It is a column of wind and words. Stroke your forehead. Thought dwells in its caverns,
Imagination lives in there. You are the handiwork of the Creator. You are God's best art, God's poem, God's portrait, God's image, God's face, and God's junk. And if God took thought to create you, why would you let a sinner define you? God wrapped a towel-like space around the holy body, then contemplated the intricacy of your hands. God troweled the curve of your brow, fashioned the tug of your mouth and the twitch of your tongue, jeweled your eye, carved your bones as surely as the mountains are carved. God conceived of time in the instant that your heart began to thump, and in the blink of your eyelid. God made galaxies and metagalaxies, the dusty infinitude of the universe, and then filled your mind with dreams. You are not an accident. You were planned. You are the cunning intention of Almighty God. Well then, shall you think ill of yourself? No, you shall think as well of yourself as you do of any marvel of God. Please, my sister, do not allow this sinner to steal you from yourself. You are too rare. No matter what filth has befouled you, your soul is unique in the cosmos. There is none like you. Whatever thing you admire, a leaf, a cup, a sunset, you are more beautiful. Sleep peacefully, child. God loves you, and so do I. And so ought you in the morning light, when the dew is a haze of blue innocence. You are God's, and the angels spread their wings above you. So, I published that because I had the permission of the woman whose name I have not told you. And then we got letters. We got letters and letters from the Lutheran Church. Well, that's the Lutheran magazine. Letters and letters. We got over 100 letters in, I don't know how, a month, which is an amazing amount of letters, since every one of them was filled with not criticism, but sighs and stories. All of them but one were from women. And almost everyone had a story to tell. Almost everyone. And so Than and I would stand in the kitchen reading these letters to each other and weeping over these stories. How many women had been abused by pastors? How many by people who were in authority? But I saw two things happening in that process, in this event within our church. The first is that they are willing to write me, with my name and my personhood and whoever I am, their stories. Which is wonderful, you understand. This is the song. Gesang ist Gesang. I sing, you answer. I create the antiphon, you create the verses. I sing, and you find a place in which you can begin to sing your story back. And the fact that you do your story at all strikes me that there is some protection here. There is something that has gone out, that you're not totally crashed. It is not as if this world is so dangerous that you don't speak a word. You speak a word. There's a place. And when you speak a word, then we make this music together. All you do is write me the letter. But here's the second thing that happened, and this just overwhelmed me. Not a single one of those letters was anonymous. Every one of them had a name. Wow, I thought, something good is happening. Something bad is revealed. Something good is happening. Something horrible is here. Something good is happening. I wrote Chilstrom when I saw all that stuff, and I told him what was happening in the church, and he, he must have known, but he began then to talk to bishops about this thing. This is art, and you know, it plays its soft role. I can choose, and it starts. Do you see how I mean now? I mean, this is a true story, but let it become an analogous now. It starts two of us. It starts a girl child, and actually three of us, because it was Than and me together. It starts a girl child and us and our response and how we do with it and how we're willing to live in that sorrow and not immediately put platitudes to it, not crank out the platitudes to it, not play the games that are the easy ones, huh? I mean, I know what's said so often, and I understand why it's said, but my whole theology took a shift through this. What is often said to this child is, well, you know that you're a Christian, you must do what?
Forgive.
You must forgive.
Oh! Confession.
Oh, my heaven. Forgive. No. First of all, you know, this person needs forgiveness. There's person really needs forgiveness, but I think the one that this person should go through for forgiveness is God. Go before the assizes. This is not a small sin about the size of a strip of licorice candy. This is massive. This is what makes the universe tremble. And so when you confess, you know, go to the size of this and go to that place where forgiveness is sure to come. Go to God. And if you have to, if there needs that mediation, then definitely go to a pastor, go to someone, but say, this is my sin. See, and I know by all kinds of experience that this is possible. And it isn't just that you go to therapists. Now I'm talking all myself, but therapists can be infinitely helpful. But at some point you say, no, this is a sin. This is a dangerous and damning sin. And I committed it. The child who is hurt does not have to forgive. What she needs is this sense of the fullness and the trueness of her own place within the universe. What she needs to speak is a way in which she speaks the forgiving, but she needs to speak the truth, which is that what looked like a relationship is no relationship at all, is a separation. It's a violence of a separation. And the more she can tell that story and put this person away, the more she's not doing anything at all. She's just realizing what has always been the truth. Now, I'm going to say one thing after this yet, but see, then I began to think about grace, and I began to think about forgiveness out of this whole thing. If ever we say to anyone who has been wounded, you must forgive, what we have done is turn the most sweet, gracious thing of our faith into a law. We have taken forgiveness from under the gracious economy of God and Jesus on the cross, and we put it on that holy mountain of Sinai. And we say, no, the cross isn't for you. You have to do something to make it right. What a perversion of forgiveness. It's God who forgives, and God who sometimes, by gracious, miraculous power, empowers us also to forgive. And when that happens, what a blooming it is. But we don't have to do it. I was interviewed by the Chicago Tribune once, because there was this case where a family lost a son to a murder, and they were forgiving the person who had murdered. In fact, they went and they hugged him. And so all of a sudden, the Tribune is saying, isn't this wonderful, they're forgiving. And they're talking to all these pastors, and every pastor says, well, of course, that's right, that's what they should do, they're Christian. That's the characteristic of a Christian. Yes, it's a characteristic of a Christian, but not one that we strive for as if we must go to the cross and die. One, rather, that is granted unto us, that happens sweetly because we have a source outside of ourselves in God. I was the only one who said, no, she doesn't have to forgive. And I got these letters from pastors. What do you mean she doesn't have to forgive? Then she's not a Christian. No. I didn't intend to tell you this next thing, but I'm going to because it fits. I just veered off right now. In this state, actually, a few years ago, this is, by the way, I did write this up. It's in my book called Holy Prayer. But to me, it's marvelous. In this state, a few years ago, not in this place, not here, not in Holden Village, although it was something like that, I was lecturing for a week in a place, and I was lecturing about women in the Bible, especially the four women that are identified in the genealogy of Jesus and some of the difficulties and so forth. And there was a woman sitting there who was extremely alert. She was one of these talky types, but not to me, she talks to herself. It's really good listener because as I'm talking, she's murmuring, and I realize what she's doing is repeating or talking about or questioning, and every once in a while she leans forward, raises her voice, and it becomes a question or a comment. One of those, you know, where she shoots a comment out and lands right here, plunk. Not quite sure what to do about it, but you're going to think about that comment for a while because you're not quite sure what's going on in her mind. Well, she and I fell to talking one day. It was a rainy day, and so we were sitting in a kind of a dining hall area, and she started telling me her story. This is her story, and it is to me amazing, and it's the other side. She told me that when she was young, I won't go through all the details, you don't need them, but when she was young, she said she lived in a very large house, and that from the outside, anyone would think that it was spacious. To her, it seemed squalid and small, because the rooms inside were large, and therefore there were only few rooms, which meant that she slept in the same bedroom as her brothers did. And she told me that at a certain point, her father came and abused her with some regularity, always, I guess, assuming that the brothers were too young. They were on the other side of a half wall and were not aware of what was going on. And she told me how she lived through that for a while and that suddenly it stopped and so forth and so on. She said she didn't say anything about it until the time came for, what was it, herself or her brother to go off to college? Her brother.
She had herself moved away from it. I'm really compacting all this, and you must realize that. She had, through the help, honestly, of a very blessed pastor, come to understand what was going on and that it wasn't her sin. And she had also begun to nourish a kind of an anger against her family, but it was unspoken. It was a very strong rage, but it was unspoken. She believed fairly clearly that her mother must have known something was gone. She tried several times to talk to her mother. You know, it was her hair. Her father used to stroke her hair. And this to me is a very moving thing. And she thought that she was at fault and that maybe her hair was at fault. And so at one point she took a scissors to cut her hair off, as if somehow or other, you understand, that this would do away with all this evil that she thought was her own. It was in talking to someone else. By the way, and at that point her mother knew the hair was cut off and must have realized something, but never said anything. So her anger was certainly against her father and her mother, but it was silent. Then came the time when her younger brother, was going to go off to college and took her for a ride in the car. As they were talking in the car, he said, "I'm sorry," to her. And she just galvanized. He was driving. She's sitting up. He said, "I'm sorry." She said, "For what?" And he said, "That we never did anything." She said, "About what?" He said, "What Dad was doing to you." And to her, that moment was like throwing open a door. Because suddenly, I mean, whether she was in denial or not, I don't know, but all of a sudden, for the first time, she was confronted with the thing, even her brother's room. And she exploded in that car, crying, but not abject tears, just anger. Oh, she just raged. She just raged at her brother, who, you know, I'm all the people who might not have gotten it. You don't make choices, man. It was the storm of the Lord that hit him on the right side of his face, and she got out of that car. And she lived in that rage for a while, and it was good. This is the first she expressed it, and she said, and it was very good. And she at least did this service to her parents. I don't think they took it as a service. She did it, where she went to them and told them how angry she was. That was a service. That was good. She didn't just walk away. She went and said how angry she was, and she didn't brook any response. Man, I can hardly get over what she was doing here. How strong is it? She wasn't going to listen to any justification from her father. She wasn't going to listen to any from her mother. She just wanted them to know she knew and that she was just horribly angry at it. Terribly angry, and she left, and of course she was living on her own by this time, and she, in effect, cut relationships. Now she's telling me this whole story. I'm sitting here drinking coffee, and the rain goes away, and the sun comes out, and we're still sitting there, and I'm so moved with this part of her story, but that's not the point. And I don't know why she chose to give me the point. She said about 2 years before the time she and I were sitting there, and I wish I could be more dramatic about this. I wish I could make you feel it. She said one morning she woke up and she had forgiven them. She said she woke up and she had forgiven them, and she hadn't worked on it. She didn't have to work on it. She didn't think about working on it, because all the stuff she'd worked through was very, very clear. This is not her business. She did not have to forgive. They needed forgiveness. She was too small. The victim doesn't have to turn around and forgive. Let God forgive. That way you don't have to feel like you're consigning them to hell. God is there. There are a whole lot of angels of God floating around these poor people who, yes, are abject. I mean, they need some kind of help. They absolutely do. They are also people or children of God that needs, but it's not her business. Nevertheless, she said she woke up one morning, and the first thing that struck her as she was lying in bed is that she had completely forgiven them. Oh, she felt so joyful. But it wasn't her work. It was a grace. It was a gift. Now I begin to understand how this happens. The same God who will forgive them will come and at some point grant you also this, and I'm going to call it this miraculous ability to forgive. And then when you wake up with that, it is, honestly, in a sense, it is as if a chain is loosed. It's the chain you didn't even know was there. But it wasn't the chain that was going to drag you down. You were going to live your life very good. It's the chain of your history. It's the chain of that past. It's the chain of the thing that you moved on beyond, but all of a sudden, you're free. And yes, you might write them a letter and say, you know, I've forgiven you. And maybe they'll understand, and maybe they won't. And yes, you don't have to write that letter either, but when she told me that, and I saw in her face, well, I know what I saw in her face. I saw Jesus in her face. I saw that grace that is given unto us. Yes, she was a Christian. She always was. But this is how the Christian is a Christian, in this sense of forgiveness, that all of a sudden the miracle happens. You know, there they are at the wedding. And they have run out of wine. And Mary goes to her son and says, they've run out of wine. And he says, what you mean? It's not my hour. What, you and me? What do we have to do to you? It's not my hour. My hour is not that. But, you know, she's bold. Mary's bold. She always is bold. So no matter what her son says, she acts like the mother. She's a Jewish mother. Remember this. Yeah, yeah, sure, she says to him. Yeah, sure. And immediately goes to the servants, and now when he talks to you, you're going to just do everything he says. I know he'll be here in just a minute. You just watch. Pretty soon he's going to screw his face up and think. When he starts thinking like that, get ready. He's going to walk over and talk to you. So he does. He walks over and he says, fill these pitchers with water to the brim. Now you must know that this takes place in the second chapter of John. And what do the disciples know about Jesus at this point? A few things. They're saying things like the anointed one, but they don't really know fully what that means, the Lamb of God that takes away the sin. They don't know fully what that means. So anyway, these jars are filled with water, and then Jesus says unto one of these people, servants, take a cup of that, take it to the master of ceremonies, and let that fellow have a sip. See what he thinks. And I think some of the disciples are following behind. What in heaven's name is this? A sip of water. And the guy takes a sip, and it's wine. It's wine, and it should have been water. It should have been water, but it turned to wine. Something in those earthen vessels happened, and you know the disciples are going to whip around and say, God is here. Water should be water. It shouldn't be wine. When you drink wine that was water, you have to whip around and say, God is here somewhere. God must be in that one. This, says John, was the first sign that Jesus did so that his disciples would believe on him. These moments, you know, when all of a sudden the miracle happens that should not have happened, become the profound evidence God is here. And that's what my interlocutor, my sweet storyteller, made me aware of when she was sitting at the table. She did the thing that she could not have done. Not that she didn't have to. She could not have done it. But she did it. And it's like she who is water in earthen vessel suddenly is wine. What a delicious, delightful thing. God is here. And then you don't look behind anymore. You say, here. God is here. So that's the sweetness of forgiveness. I had forgotten. It wasn't that I come and I go through this horrible thing, which, you know, sometimes it is horrible. We can talk about that element of forgiveness too sometimes. But that all of a sudden it happens, and I have the sweet, delicious joy to say, oh, God is in me. What a gift that is. I mean, that's the hugeness of this gift. Sure, yeah, I forgave, you know, and I let loose whatever that, but God is in me. Now how do you walk those roads when it is the deity in your soul? Now what do your feet feel when they step on those stones? Now what do you think when you look up at the clouds, as she says, these series of clouds that roll through the heavens? The very same God who just chuckled in the mountains this day is the one that sings in your heart. Alles ist Gesang. Gesang ist Dasein. This is the holy song. Some of the people who dwelt in my own darkness and out of that darkness created for me a sense of holy order are Thomas Wolfe, who wrote Le Combre d'Angel, when my own family was an explosive place to be. If you have not read that book, maybe you don't need to. But it's a book in which Thomas Wolfe grows up in a family where there's just, oh, there's such torment and force. But he always says this phrase over and over again because he remembers the sweetness of his childhood. Oh, lost, he says, and by the wind grieved, ghost, come back again. I read that when I was a freshman in high school, and I began to understand the mortal forces of my family. Some of the artists that have walked with me, Moses, whatever that meant, with this beautiful poem of the law, this ordering of existence by the sweet goodness of the law, God says, look, I love you. My law will be good for you. Don't have anyone else's. I proved it. I proved it. I'm the one who brought you out of bondage. Remember that? Yeah, I'm the one. I'm the one who took you out of slavery. I'm the one who gives you a name. I'm giving you a job. I am your God. I'm the only one who's proven to you. Don't ever have any gods besides me. If you have, I'm afraid you will have someone. If you have any other God besides me, you will, by your worship, end up obeying. Any other God will command you. I'm the only one that can save you. Moses, for me. Dostoevsky. Oh, the Beats. I'm 50. Forgive me. I just made a list here. These people I read just furiously, and I thought they were working something out altogether. And in the end, I'm not sure that they altogether got there. Jack Kerouac, On the Road. Anyone know that? Read that? Some of you? Do you know Ken Kesey? Sometimes a Great Notion. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was a part of these Merry Prankster people. He used to get on a bus and drive from California into the big cities in the east, dancing on top of the bus, painted in day gold colors. And if you were walking along the street, they would dance you to you. And it was, and the whole issue was, would you ever recognize that they were dancing you to you? That's how they lived their lives. And one of the, and the guy driving the bus is a guy named Moriarty, who is in the book called On the Road. Wild guy, died on the railroad track. He's also the main one in the electric Kool-Aid acid test. Yeah, he's the bus driver, Moriarty, in there. Oh, Cassidy is his real name. He's called Cassidy, and Moriarty is in there. Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, Getty, those people for a while, I know they were working at something. They didn't all know each other, but they came to know each other. They were working hard at something. They were working hard at a mess. Others, Bernard Malamud, William Faulkner, Keats, Coleridge, more than Keats, Coleridge. I'm doing this for my own sake. It may mean absolutely nothing to you, but Coleridge is the guy who knows despair. Coleridge goes into this bleak despair, and he comes up singing the sweetest of tunes. You know, in Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure lord decree. That came out of a blue. What was he smoking then? No, he was drinking it. Oh, Donovan. Yeah, but Coleridge. What I'm saying is we are surrounded, dear people, by a host, a great host of witnesses, a cloud of witnesses, artists. And if it is your good pleasure sometimes to know one well, or to, I mean, if it's also your great sorrow to be one, God bless you. Bless you for the choices you make. But if you have the insight to recognize the artists when they are around you, please don't coddle them. Don't pat them on the head. Don't think that they're the slightly crazy ones that balance the rest, and we need these little buzzing crazy people among us. Please, they are our prophets. And that's why we sometimes want to shed ourselves with them. They are our prophets, and they're not always going to put sweet arms around you and comfort you. They'll know the pain. Don't pat them on the head. Be patient. Grant them a place. Feed them when they're hungry. Sometimes they're desperately hungry. If you possibly can and you're in a church, work up a little bit of money, huh? Pay for them. Used to be the churches honored their artists. That was the Roman Catholic Church. We left a lot behind when we left Roman Catholics. We don't even honor our musicians very well, and we're Lutherans. We just burden them with a lot of work. Artists who dance, artists who work in colors and in shapes, honor them, please. And the honoring means be patient upon them, wait upon them, and dwell in what they do. Don't stand on the outside. Doesn't do anything for me. Learn the language. Do you understand? Just an appeal here at the end. We are all among you. And much of what we do, I mean, we withdraw from you, we're very shy, we hide, you can't see us, you cry out loud, and we look like any other normal human being because we're scared of your cry. But we're there. And we can't help it. That's the prophet thing, you know. That kid plunking on that guitar, just irritating himself because he can't get it quite right. That's Isaiah saying, oh, not my, that's Jeremiah saying, I'm too young. I don't want to do this. And very often that's how the artist, at some point the artist is saying, I don't want to do this, and there's that drivenness. Honor that. And if in parishes you're wondering what to do with this little bequest that you got, and somewhere in there is an artist who's working very hard but is simply at the stage of learning the craft, become, what is that old word? Let's resurrect it. Patron. Mm-hmm. Become a patron. If you will, a matron. Become patron matrons of the arts. The church used to do it. And then ask them to do serious things for you. I'm past time. I'm glad that you grant me this opportunity to make my plea on behalf of arts. This is what's good for Holden, is that they do that. They offer the place. Thanks a lot.